This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We start today with a conversation with writer David Budbill. Budbill is well known in Vermont and beyond for his play Judevine. He's also a poet of note. Always an energetic guest, in 2010, Budbill was on Vermont Edition discussing a new play and a forthcoming book.
I'm just getting warmed up. I've got so many projects going that I think the 70s for me are going to be hell-bent for leather. I'm not slowing down at all. And so that's one of the things that I think is kind of contraindicated about aging. I don't feel like slowing down a bit.
Well, as it so often does, other things intervened. Over a year ago, Budbill was diagnosed with a degenerative condition that has changed his life significantly. I recently visited him at his home in Montpelier to talk about his current life and work.
I have a PSP, which is a specialized form of Parkinson's disease, a progressive postnuclear palsy. I can't stand up, and my eyesight and my vision, my handwriting have gone to hell in a handbasket. But other than that, I'm perfectly normal.
You say perfectly normal, but from what I've read, what you've told people about your emotional life dealing with this diagnosis and your changing physical bodies, sounds like there may be also depression that goes along with it for you.
A lot of depression, because my life has been totally altered. I can't do anything physical, and I have a walker, this thing, and I walk with it everywhere I go. And when I'm not in that walker, I'm in a wheelchair. So it's a wheelchair or a walker for me. And that's enormously depressing.
Because of the loss of autonomy and your physical self, or for other reasons?
Well, mostly for the loss of autonomy, because I'm totally dependent on others for locomotion. And I don't have any time that I'm not with somebody else. And that in itself is, especially for me, depressing. I have lots of things I did that I don't do anymore, like cut wood.
Do you miss cutting wood at all?
Oh, I miss it terrifically. It is one of my favorite things to do.
I've always gotten that sense from you, and you know, for so many people, it's a chore that you do, and you try to find some ability to, maybe as you have, find a little bit of zen in it, but not something that people would miss if they got rid of. But it is something you miss.
Oh, it certainly is. I am not one of those people who doesn't miss it. I miss it terrifically. I miss all parts of it. I miss the dirty, sweaty, oil and gas stained clothes. I miss walking to the woods. I miss cutting the wood. I miss everything about it. Limbing it up, even stacking the brush, which is the least favorite thing to do. I like all parts of it.
I think you're the only person I know who's written so eloquently and lovingly about stacking wood.
Oh, really? Well, that's too bad, because I think it's one of the great joys of life. I get such a sense of satisfaction when the woodshed is full and we're ready for winter.
You said your handwriting has gone to hell in a handbasket, but you have several books coming out.
I do. I have three books coming out in the next year. And I, when I got this diagnosis, which was about a year ago, I hustled those into print. I finished them. because I knew that they might be my last books. And one's a children's book, and one's a novel, and one's a collection of poems.
Are you working on anything currently?
I'm not. I don't have any current projects. Well, I do have one. I have a book called Parkinson's that I'm starting to write. I've written one poem called How It All Began. And I don't know whether I'll be able to write that or not. The time will tell.
Titling the work Parkinson's in some ways doesn't leave a lot to the imagination, but you have always had such a vibrant imagination and a way with words. I'd love to know what maybe not reciting that poem, but maybe you can tell me a little bit about the poem that you have written for that so far.
Well, the one I've written is called How It All Began, and it explains how it all began, which is why it's called How It All Began. I was planting potatoes, and I kept falling over into the row, and I couldn't get up. And it's opened over and over and over again. And that's the first time that it actually dawned on me that something was amiss. I had, since then, I've thought about plenty of symptoms prior to that, but only after this initial incident.
Why is that the only poem that you've written so far?
Oh, that's a good question. That's the only one that's come to me so far. That's why.
Do you think more will come to you, or are you worried that they won't?
I hope they will, although I'm worried that they won't.
Is that worry that poems won't continue to come to you something new, or is that something you've always worried about?
I think it's something new. Although I can't say for sure.
When people like me now come over to your place and interview you and talk about your life and your life's work, but also talk about what you're experiencing right now, I imagine I would bristle a little bit because I would feel a little bit like the Johnny-come-latelys are coming to cash in on suffering. Is that something that you feel in the press that you're getting?
I don't say it in those terms. I don't really think I bristle. But I know what you mean about Johnny-come-latelys. Although I'm not sure it applies to me. I'm not sure.
Well, certainly not the Johnny-come-lately. I mean, you have had accolades for many, many years, and you've had a multitude of interviews and people who are addressing your work, but it must feel a little different to have to talk about yourself and things that are so intimate and personal to you.
It does, and I don't know how I cope with it. I just do.
Well, David Budwill, I look forward to reading the work that's coming out at the end of this year, and I hope for more.
I hope you get the chance to get more. We'll see.
David Budwill, writer, poet, author, important Vermont cultural touchstone. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Coming up, we'll be joined by author Nathaniel Philbrick to talk about something completely different. We're going to look at Benedict Arnold, his role in the Revolutionary War, and why his name has become synonymous with treason. Does he really deserve that reputation? You can add your thoughts by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition, or call 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. All right, so Benedict Arnold, what do we think of him? This is a guy whose name is synonymous with treason. And if the mythology of America's founding has a villain, it is Benedict Arnold, a once heroic Revolutionary War general who betrayed his country and nearly lost the war for the colonies. But that's a little simplistic, isn't it? Maybe it's time for Arnold to have a small modicum of redemption. After all, didn't Vermont's much-lauded Green Mountain boy Ethan Allen seem to play both sides as well, engaging in talks with the British while also fighting for the cause? Is Benedict Arnold just misunderstood? Best-selling historian Nathaniel Philbrick has worked to piece together the story behind Benedict Arnold and his betrayal, from his naval battles on Lake Champlain to his complicated relationship with George Washington. It's all in a new book called Valiant Ambition: George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Philbrick joins us today to talk about it. What a pleasure to have you with us, Nathaniel.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Why should we care about or have sympathy for a traitor like Benedict Arnold?
Well, I think like most things in history, the shorthand doesn't do justice to the actual story. Yes, he would attempt to sell out his country, but after many years of bitterness and betrayal he felt from his own government, the fact of the matter is he was, in the beginning, one of our best generals. And he was not necessarily lauded by his own government, while the British seemed to have a great appreciation for his abilities as a fighter. You know, he was a very tempestuous human being, someone whose passions made him fight like no other on the battlefield, but made it difficult for him when it came to interacting with his own officers and the politicians. But the fact of the matter is, a lot happened in America to disenchant him with how the revolution was going.
Well, let's start sort of at the beginning so that we have a context for what happened with him and why he may have felt somewhat entitled, I guess, or justified in his actions when he turned to the British. Benedict Arnold was, at one point, a celebrated revolutionary militant. He was a young businessman to start with. Remind us of his role in the Continental Army and why he first supported the American cause.
Yeah, well, as soon as he heard of Lexington and Concord, he put together a company of soldiers in his hometown of New Haven and marched to Boston. And by that time, he had come up with he realized that the Lake Champlain was absolutely critical to the strategic integrity of America. If the British should get control of that and the Hudson River, they could cut New England off from the rest of the colonies that were eventually to become states and win the war. And so he proposed to the officials in Boston that he take Fort Ticonderoga, which he knew was full of cannons that the American army needed and was poorly defended. And it was at around this time that others, perhaps because they heard the idea first from Benedict Arnold, also had the same idea. And so by the time Arnold arrived at the southern end of Lake Champlain, Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys were also had this as something they were going to do. But it was only Arnold who really had a legitimate commission from an existing government. And so, as it turned out, he and Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen would go side by side into Ticonderoga. And
uncomfortably so, right? I mean, they didn't exactly want to be side by side.
No, and, you know, Arnold was a difficult person, but so was Ethan Allen. And so the two of them were very reluctant co-conspirators in this. And it's interesting. As soon as they took Fort Ticonderoga, Allen and the Green Mountain Boys proceed to get drunk on the British liquor supply, and it's Arnold who commandeers a schooner from a loyalist and sails up the length of Lake Champlain and attacks the British at St. John's and takes some additional vessels, burns what he can't take with him, and now has control of the entire lake. And so you could argue that it was Arnold that really had the strategic vision that made this all possible. And actually, Allen would belatedly head north and ultimately be captured by the British. And so it's an interesting comparison there.
We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick, and we're looking at the story of Benedict Arnold. Traitor, misunderstood revolutionary, caught up in complicated affairs. Should he get some redemption? And we're just finding out what it was, again, that he did at Fort Ticonderoga. If you have a question about Benedict Arnold, or if you'd like to share a thought with Nathaniel Philbrick, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition and Facebook page. So do you think that Ethan Allen either stole his credit or we have unjustifiably given the credit for the capture of Fort Ticonderoga to Ethan Allen? Because in these parts, at least, the popular telling is that Ethan Allen may have been an upstart, but he's the one who really made it happen.
Yeah, oh, you know, I think it Arnold's reputation obviously suffered once he became a traitor, and so no one really wanted to give him credit for much of anything. But I think if you view what happened there as objectively as you can, you can see that both of them contributed, and in a very uneasy alliance, made it happen. And you know, and Vermonters quite rightly are proud of Allen, and he's the local guy, so you might as well give him the credit. But the fact of the matter is, Arnold was just as involved, if not more so, in realizing the importance of Fort Ticonderoga and making it happen.
So how did Benedict Arnold then capitalize on his victory at Fort Ticonderoga for his own personal gain and for the cause?
Well, ultimately, he would return to Boston in August of 1775. By this time, George Washington was commander of what would become the Continental Army. And what Washington was mired in would be a nine-month siege of Boston. But he could see to the north that there were opportunities. And the British had only a small group of soldiers in Montreal and Quebec. And already a group of American soldiers were headed up Lake Champlain and would take Montreal. But the real hard one was getting Quebec. It would require soldiers to go overland through what is now the wilds of western Maine and up the Penobscot River. And by this time, it was getting close to fall. And it would be Arnold that would lead a ragtag band through the wilderness. And it was just an incredible feat. He would lose a third of his men to desertion and death, but eventually stagger out of the wilderness and arrive at the gates of Quebec. He would win this would win him the title of the American Hannibal. And ultimately, the attack on Quebec would be unsuccessful, and Arnold his left leg would be badly injured. But nonetheless, it was clear this was a guy who was making it happen. This was a guy that if you gave him something to do, he would do absolutely everything he could to accomplish it. And in the meantime, many other American generals were having anything but stellar success in trying to move forward the American cause.
Before we get into what actually made Benedict Arnold turn traitor or decide that he wasn't getting his fair shake from the Continental Army, he was later back on Lake Champlain trying to prevent the British from recapturing Ticonderoga, and he was involved in some battles there. Unsuccessful, but he does deserve some credit for helping keep the British at bay.
Oh, absolutely. You could argue that in the fall of 1776, it was Arnold who saved America, because by that time, Washington had moved to New York, lost to the British in the Battle of Long Island. The British had occupied New York, and Washington's army was sent reeling across the breadth of New Jersey and would eventually end up on the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware River. The British could now go up the Hudson, and if another invasionary force coming down from Canada, down Lake Champlain, could link up with them, the war would be over. And the only person between that fate and America was Benedict Arnold with 15 vessels that he had helped build. And it was up to them to stop this huge British invasionary force from taking Fort Ticonderoga that fall. And at the Battle of Valcour Island, he would battle the British to a draw, which was really amazing given the fact that how severely outgunned he was. And he would put up such a staunch resistance that the British began to look at the calendar and say, you know, Lake Champlain freezes in November. Maybe we should delay this to the following year. And Arnold had done it. The British would return to Canada, and America was saved for that year. And he had also set up what would be, a year later, the great American victory at the Battle of Saratoga.
We're talking today about Benedict Arnold. We're learning more about what he was all about, what his role was in the Revolutionary War, and certainly at the time, at least, why he was considered so important to the cause. And his reputation has sullied some of his important victories at the early part of the war. And if you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. All right, so Nathaniel Philbrick, it sounds like Benedict Arnold was a really great revolutionary. What made him actually turn to the British?
Well, after the Battle of Saratoga in the fall of 1777, a great victory that would ultimately bring in the French on the side of America, Arnold was terribly injured in the left leg, which he had already injured in Quebec. He would be months confined to a bed. The leg that would eventually emerge from it would be 2 inches shorter than the other one. And he had been treated terribly by his commanding officer at Saratoga, Horatio Gates. And by this time, the Continental Congress had chosen to overlook him for promotion to Major General. And so he was embittered by that. And then after his experience at Saratoga, where Horatio Gates would become the great hero of that battle, when actually you could argue that it was Arnold's soldiers that actually won it, he began to question, I've given almost everything but my life. He couldn't walk for another year unassisted. It would be 2 years before he could ride a horse. You know, why am I doing this? You could argue that the Battle of Saratoga would really begin his slide into bitterness that would ultimately lead to him deciding to betray his country.
We got a note from Elizabeth, who posted a question on Facebook from her 13-year-old daughter, Abigail, who wants to know why there isn't more focus on his treatment and that is what brought him to this betrayal. Why in history classes aren't we taught more about how Benedict Arnold felt betrayed before he became the betrayer?
Because, you know, I think to do that, it's much easier to assume that he was evil from the start and that it was only later that his true nature was revealed. It's kind of disturbing to think that here was someone who was giving his all for America, was overlooked by his own government, and grew embittered. And that's harder. It's harder. It's easier to see him as pure evil. And when it comes to the mythology of America, we have the great hero George Washington, and Arnold has become the villain. And it's given us our creation story. And so to see him as someone who had his reasons for doing this, is a more difficult and complex story. But it is closer to the truth.
So Elizabeth and Abigail, who wrote in, also were wondering about Benedict Arnold's wife's role in his decision. And before we get your answer to that, Nathaniel, let's play a little clip here. And this is from the Comedy Central TV series Drunk History. If you're not familiar with it, it is what it sounds like. It's drunk narrators deciding to retell stories from American history. And in this episode, podcaster and comedian Aaron McGathy explains Benedict Arnold's betrayal. And the clip actually begins with McGathy speaking as Arnold's wife, Peggy Shippen.
You know, the British would appreciate you. They would love you. Also, my family's British. Benedict's like, no, I'm not gonna defect to the British side. That's insane. George Washington is my daddy, kind of. Peggy says, look, I have a friend in the British Army, John Andre. Benedict's like, it's like your ex-boyfriend. Peggy's like, well, I mean, Benedict, if you really want to be with me, be more confident.
We're talking today with Nathaniel Philbrick. He is a writer and historian. We're talking about Benedict Arnold. We'll get him right back on here. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. If you'd like to share your thoughts, we got a note from Jerry who says, I just finished Valiant Ambition, and I was so impressed with the scholarship as well as the writing, especially the ending. It read like a Le Carré novel. Spies, danger, escape, retribution, personal ambition, hubris, and even sexual seduction. We are talking with Nathaniel Philbrick today, and we will come back to him after a break. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of a new book about old stories. It's been making big waves. The book is called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. If you have a question about Benedict Arnold's roles in some important battles right here in our neck of the woods, or about how he's been portrayed in American history, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Nathaniel Philbrick, we had played a clip from Drunk History that suggested that Benedict Arnold's wife, Peggy, was one of the motivating factors in getting him to turn to the British. And she certainly was one of the go-betweens between him and the British as he tried to figure out what his next move was. But was Peggy Shippen, Arnold's wife, a push towards the British, do you think?
Absolutely. She came from a very well-to-do Philadelphia family that had royal connections prior to the Revolution. But once the Revolution broke out, her father was doing everything he could to straddle the political fence. And during the brief British occupation of Philadelphia, she and her sisters had greatly enjoyed socializing with the young British officers. And one of them was Major John Andre, who actually was very talented in terms of knew three languages, was a great artist, and he's done a beautiful sketch of her, and she was a beautiful 18-year-old woman. And when the British were forced to leave, Arnold became a military commander of this war-torn city, immediately surrounded in controversy, but he was in love because he had met Peggy Shippen. He was a widower, 36 years old. She was literally half his age, and she was appalled by how he was being treated by his own country and had greatly enjoyed her time with the British, and they fell in love, would eventually marry. And within a month of their wedding, Arnold would send out his first feelers to the British, to none other than John Andre, that officer whom Peggy had known and who would become the British spy chief. And so Peggy, I think, was definitely a factor. She obviously was whispering in his ear, saying, you know, look at how your own country is treating you. The British obviously have more respect for you than your own country, and the other side of this was America was falling apart at this point. Instead of a national government, we were fracturing into 13 states that were really had no interest in funding the revolution. Washington's army was without the provisions and military supplies it needed. And Arnold was beginning to think, we've given up on the bond we had made among each other with the Declaration of Independence, and it's time to bring in the British to return us to the liberties we had enjoyed before the Revolution. And so that's what, with Peggy's help, that's what he began to think was the thing to do.
So, I mean, it sounds like there were several motivating factors. I mean, one was that Benedict Arnold had this wife, Peggy, who was saying, hey, you know, I've got a friend here and right. with the British. I've got this intermediary for you. I can make this happen. It sounds like there was some pragmatism involved in his decision about, you know, what is the future of this country that I've been fighting for? And is it one that I want to continue fighting for? Was there greed involved, too, do you think?
Yep. And that was really the third and factor that makes Arnold's decision ultimately reprehensible. Arnold had been a well-off merchant before the Revolution and had actually given much of his own personal wealth to the cause in those early years. The Continental Congress had no interest in compensating him for that lost money. And in order to afford Peggy when it came to the wedding, he had to make it clear to her father that he had the economic wherewithal to allow her to live in the lifestyle that she had become used to. So he had taken out this huge loan to buy her a mansion on the river. And, you know, he was way over his head economically. And so he began to look at
the possibility of selling out his country as a way to gain some of that lost income. And so he, in the more than year and a half, he would negotiate with the British to ultimately turn over West Point, which had become our predominant fortress on the Hudson River, to turn that over to the British. He made sure to negotiate a price of more than £10,000, which was a significant sum at that point. And so, you know, ultimately, Arnold could say what he would about doing it for the good of his country, but ultimately, he was doing this to make as much money as possible in the process.
I'm going to play you another clip here, and this is from the AMC series Turn, Washington Spies. It tells the story of Revolutionary War era espionage, and it's been focusing on Benedict Arnold in recent series. In this scene, Arnold has redecorated his Philadelphia mansion with confiscated goods, and when the commissioner of forfeiture tries to object, Arnold flies off the handle.
Your reimbursement will have to wait, as I have been forced to wait for 3 years for Congress to repay me £1 of the £10,000 owed to me. 3 whole years fighting for our country with no recompense save wounds got in battle while you sit in a chair sequestering.
Now, that's very dramatic, Nathaniel, but it also sort of illustrates his real bitterness with what he felt like he deserved and hadn't been getting, not just payment, but also commissions and promotions that he felt like he was passed over for.
Yeah, and you know, but it's interesting. In my book, I compare Arnold with Washington, and Washington also had his own trials he had to deal with, and yet he had the patience and the long view to work his way through these kinds of travails. But Arnold wasn't that way. He was passionate. He the only mode he knew was attack, and when the government was unresponsive to his quite legitimate anger, he decided he had to do something about it, and that's what makes him unique. That's how he had dealt with life up until this point. Was that when he was in a tight spot, he would find a way to get out of it. And for him, turning traitor, turning West Point over to the British, was the way to not only enrich himself, but to save a country that was, to his eyes, falling apart. And so, it's an interesting question of was this simply an act of protest in which he was legitimately airing his concerns, or was it treason in which he was undercutting the bond that Americans had made to one another? And, I think it's clearly treason. But
Think it's really treason?
It is treason. But, you know, that's what makes it such an interesting story. You know, we are a republic, and political discourse to get at what is the will of the people requires us to debate, to protest when we feel necessary, it's a messy and difficult process. And for Arnold, who became upset with the process, he decided to take it in his own hands and do what he felt was not only good for him, but good for the nation as a whole.
So why are his decisions treason? I mean, he in his own writing to George Washington said, it may be really hard to understand. I mean, obviously, I am paraphrasing here, but he said it may be hard to understand, but I did this for the love of the country. And you get somebody like Ethan Allen, who was also trying to play both sides and says, oh, no, I really do support the American cause. I was trying to, like, you know, basically be a double agent. And here we are revering Ethan Allen and saying Benedict Arnold was a traitor. Is it just because he got found out differently?
Well, yeah. Ultimately, he was, caught with his hand in the cookie jar, and he was actually a very good traitor. He was on the edge of turning over West Point, which in the fall of 1780 would have had a devastating effect on America, and could very easily have turned it all around. And he had been able to do this without anyone suspecting him, which was pretty amazing given the spy network that Washington and others had put together. And so, Arnold's story is really a tragic one, I think, in that, it's through his treason that he gained a fame that he never came close to as a true American hero in the first years of the war. And as a country, we've come to almost need Arnold, the example of Arnold, as the ultimate traitor, evil incarnate, to have something to show that, you know, this is what, as Americans, this is what we are battling against. And so he serves a purpose when it comes to the mythology of America.
Not only that, but you argue that in some ways his exposure as a traitor actually did galvanize the colonists and helped spur the Americans to victory, which might not have happened otherwise.
Yeah. You know, by the fall of 1780, it seemed as if most Americans had just given up on the cause, turned their backs on it. If Washington should somehow win this war, would there be a country left to claim victory? And so, the word of Arnold's treason had a truly galvanizing effect. People, it was a wake-up call. He was burned in effigy in towns up and down the length of the eastern seaboard. And I think it's not an accident that within a year's time would come the victory at Yorktown. That would basically seal the winning of the War of Independence for America. Arnold would head south to Virginia as a British soldier, as a British general, and would so enrage Virginians that Washington that he would send Lafayette after him, and that would begin the whole movement of soldiers south that would ultimately climax at Yorktown. And so I think Arnold is an important part of this and underappreciated for, you know, as a general in the early years of the war, short of Washington, he did more than anyone else for the American cause. But it's as a traitor that he probably did the most to help America ultimately win the War of Independence.
Listeners, do you agree with what you're hearing? Are you willing to give Benedict Arnold that credit? If you'd like to share your thoughts, you can post them at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition. We're having a little trouble with our phones today, so the best way to share your thoughts with us is by going to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, and share a post there or on our Facebook page. Nathaniel, we got a note from Phyllis who says, is there any hint that one of the reasons behind Arnold's actions had to do with the French becoming allies with the American Revolution? Was there any fear that the French, who'd been traditional enemies only 50 years before, might make a grab to take another hold in the Americas, and that siding with the English was better than siding with the French?
Yeah, Arnold would, after he turned traitor, would claim that that was one of the reasons why he decided to do it, and his fear that if... The French were just basically using this country and if we won the war, they would take us over, and we would be a pawn for Britain, for France rather than Britain. And it's truly ironic because it was the Battle of Saratoga in which he had such an important role in bringing that victory about. That's what brought the French in, and so. You know, the legacy of Arnold is truly tormented in many ways, and but ultimately the fact that he was sold his loyalty to the highest bidder is what makes it reprehensible.
So ultimately, do you think Benedict Arnold deserves redemption, or at least a different reputation, a different position in American history, given how important he may have been to victory, even as a traitor, or especially as a traitor?
Yeah, I don't know if he deserves redemption, but what I think the story deserves is an appreciation the War of Independence. We have a tendency to look to the past and think it was a simpler time when people knew exactly what they were trying to do and they accomplished the creation of this great nation. But it wasn't that way at all. It was messy. People didn't know where it was going. They were making it up as they went along, and they were motivated by a whole host of motivations, some of them altruistic, some of them full of self-interest. Even Washington, this was true. And so Arnold was one of those people. And I think it's important that we look at something like the story of the founding of America and not see as ordained by God from the start, but as something that could have gone so many different ways that involved the passions of people in a way very similar to how we are engaged today in our political debate. It was, you know, it was a time in which it was turbulent, it was chaotic, and out of this emerged America.
That's Nathaniel Philbrick. He's author of the new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
We were just talking today on the show with two specific authors. Tomorrow, we'll talk about many authors and books. It's Vermont Edition's annual Summer Book Show. We're going to hear from booksellers and librarians around the state with their recommendations for great summer reads. And we'll find out who the finalists are for this year's Vermont Book Award. We always love your reading suggestions. Send them to vermontedition@vpr.net. And be sure to tune in for the program tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.